forward, because otherwise, if I don't see where these character defects affect me where I walk, then I'm going to dismiss them. I'll justify them. I'll do the same thing with them I've done with them all my life. They may be wrong for you, but in my case, it's different. They're right for me. I'll call them by another name and actually end up being beatified as a result of them. So what I urge the guys to do is to do that. And it becomes extremely interesting, because what happens is they begin to find out that these things, their lives really are shot through with these character defects. And character defects appear to be helpful, but they're not. They're really things that destroy us. They take away our peace of mind, our contentment, and our serenity. Is that about time? Okay. So I get them to do that, and then we go from character defect to character defect, and we talk an awful lot about it and see how they present themselves in our lives. And when we get to the sixth step, we'll see why that's important. Okay. The sixth step is one of those steps that's very easy to become theoretical about. And in reality, the sixth step is one of the most powerful linchpins for living a sane, serene, spiritual life that there is. So the fourth step, of course, is extremely important. It has to do with a yellow pad and a couple of number two pencils. I buy yellow pads by the gross at Office Depot, and I buy boxes of number two pencils, and I keep them sharpened, and I hand them out to guys. And we do a lot of work with yellow pads and number two pencils, because it's impossible to lie with a yellow pad and a number two pencil. It really is. Try it. Go to your room and write a lie on a yellow pad and a number two pencil. You'll never be able to finish. Any thoughts or questions about the fourth step? Why don't we take a break for about... Okay. Well, that was a nice break. I got to talk to some nice folks and learned a few things. We're now at step five. And step five is introduced in the 12 and 12. It talks a lot about deflation at depth. One of the early friends of Alcoholics Anonymous is a psychiatrist named Harry Tebow, Dr. Harry Tebow. And Dr. Tebow wrote a series of pamphlets, which you can often find around. And one of them is entitled The Ego Factors in the Surrendered Alcoholism. And he, along with Bill Wilson, probably described the alcoholic better than anybody or anything I've ever heard. And he talks about the need for an alcoholic to completely smash our egos. And I've often spent time with what I'm sure are very good professionals who always point out that we really need some ego. So you really need some ego. So Dr. Tebow is mistaken when he says that we have to completely smash our egos. And I like to point out to them that I think Dr. Tebow is absolutely right. And I think they're right too. I think we do need some ego in order to survive. But Tebow's theory was that if an alcoholic tries as hard as they can to completely eliminate ego, that some of them may get rid of enough of it to live. And I think that that's what the fifth step is an exercise in. It's an exercise in trying to eliminate enough ego for most of us to live. I don't think there's ever any danger that an alcoholic is going to completely rid themselves of ego. It may have happened, but if it did, they would be quiet and nobody would ever know. And he says that's done by doing a fifth step. The fifth step says admit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And I think the fifth step is, I know in my life, is one of those steps that was feared. It was very, very difficult. They kept saying to me, look, the fourth step isn't the fifth step. When you write the fourth step, focus on the fourth step on your character defect. Don't think about what you're going to do in the fifth step. And all I could do was picture my sponsor's face when I was telling him this stuff I was writing down. I could see him turning his head and throwing up into a waste can. You know. Of course, he ruined that for me because before I finished my fourth step, he said, "I want you to take your fifth step with someone else." And I said, "Why?" He's a very wise man. He said, "I'm afraid that your opinion of me is too, or my opinion of you is too important to you. And I'm afraid that that you may not tell me the whole truth." And gee, what tremendous insight he had. And I love the idea of a father being here this weekend to hear fifth steps. I've taken four fourth and fifth steps, and I've taken three of the four fifth steps with one man. His name's Ed C. from Washington, D.C., and the reason I took him with Ed was Sandy didn't want to hear it, and he said, "We'll pray, and you'll come up with the right person." And I must say that I came up with the right person. Ed was the perfect man to hear my fifth step. But Ed gave me instructions that were rather specific. He said, "I want you to do exactly what the step says." And I said, "Yeah, I will." I said, "I'll admit to God, to myself, and another human being, exact nature of my own." He said, "No, no." He said, "I want you to do exactly what it says, and I want you to do it in that order." And it suddenly occurred to me what he was saying. And maybe everybody doesn't have to do this, but I must tell you, this worked very well for me. I went to God first. If you remember last night, I talked about going into a chapel in front of the tabernacle and begging God to save my little girl's life and promise him I wouldn't drink and being drunk within 12 hours. Well, I went back to that chapel with my fourth step, and I put on a three-piece suit. I hadn't been there in a while, and I wanted to look good. And I said, "God, remember me? I used to serve 5:45 mass when nobody else wanted to. You know, you have to pave the way. You're gonna." What I did was I leveled with God for the very first time in my life. I told God the whole truth as I knew it. It astounds me when I think back at how I attempted to lie to God. I mean, he knows everything. And here I am, leaving things out, and, you know, cutting corners and all the rest of it. But for the very first time in my life, I sat there, and I was as honest as I could be with God as I understood. And then I went home, and I sat in front of a full-length mirror. You know, the kind you practice your golf swing in front of. And I sat in a chair, and I looked in the mirror, and I told myself exactly who and what I was. And you know, after I'd done that, I would have told a bus driver. I always thought I was afraid of what other people thought. And I really discovered that what I was really afraid of was me and God. That's what I was really afraid of. And I went to see Ed. And Ed was down in Ocean City, Maryland. And I knew where he was. He made the mistake of telling me. So that day, I got in the car and I drove the 3 hours or whatever it is to Ocean City. And I went and knocked on his door in the hotel, and he was surprised to see me. And I said, "Ed, I'm ready to take my fifth step." And he said, "Well, that's wonderful." He said, "Look, I got an extra bed in here. Why don't you join me, and in the morning we'll do it." And I said, "No, Ed, I want to do it now." And he said, "I understand that." And we sat down, and I shared with another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. And he asked that question at the end that I always ask the guys I hear. "Is there anything you've left out?" Well, there was a thing about the chicken, or, you know, whatever it might be, you know. I have a friend, Ed C. Dorothy knows Ed C. He's a psychiatrist. Ted always tells this story about the guy who came to him, and he was all ashamed and everything. And he said, I need to tell you this. He said, "You know, I had sex with a chicken." And Ted said to him, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yeah." And Ted said, "Well, tell me, did yours die, too?" But there's always something, you know, particularly sick to us that we sort of hold in reserve. And very rarely have I said to a guy, "Is there anything else, anything at all, that they don't go, well, I didn't think it was important, but I killed somebody," or, you know, something like that. And there always seems to be something that we hang on to. It's almost like a security blanket, you know. If I hang on to this piece of information and suck my thumb, I'll be all right. And of course, what the step requires us to do, and what humility requires us to do, is to share it all. And it's really interesting to watch the transformation that takes place in people who do the fifth step. I've heard a lot of them just recently in prisons, and I heard one not long ago, a man who's a Muslim, black Muslim, and he finished his, and he looked at me, and he just burst into tears, and he fell on his knees. It was an amazing, amazing thing. And he said, "I've got 15 years to do, but I've never been more free in my life." And I've seen people have that spontaneous reaction. Mine wasn't like that. I didn't have any sort of a light or anything like that. What I do know is that I felt empty. For the very first time in my life, I felt completely empty. I thought maybe I was faint. I mean, I seemed to be void of emotions. I seemed to be void of feelings. I even seemed to be void of opinions, and I'd never been void of opinions. I was just, for the very first time in my life, I just basically existed. And it lasted for a couple of hours. And Ed had suggested that I take the book down the beach and that I spend the next hour, like it says in step six, contemplating these first five propositions. And had I been thorough and all the rest of it. And I understood, I think for the very first time, what people experience when they're able to meditate, to be empty. To empty themselves and to meditate, that you really can hear the voice of God. And up until that time in my life, I guess I was probably 31 or 32 years old then, up until that time, the only voice I ever heard was the voice inside of my head that was constantly talking to me about what I was and what I wasn't and what I should have done and what I shouldn't have done and all the rest of it. And I think for the very first time in my life, I felt empty and free enough to possibly hear the voice of God. And now very quickly, I chased a lot of that away. But I had it for a period of time, and I never forgot it. And it's a place that I've been able to go back to frequently. The fifth step is an incredible process in lives. And like I say, all I knew was that my life began to change. And there are great promises in all through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of the best promises in the book come after the fifth step. It talks about being at peace with ourselves and the world for the very first time. And that's really how I felt for the very first time. During the next week or two, as I'd walk the streets and look at people, people looked differently to me. Where I would see them being angry before, I now saw them as frightened, or I saw them as accepting, or I saw them as a variety of things. And it occurred to me that as a result of this fifth step, people were much less a threat to me than they had been before. And I began to understand the poison that secrets really are to us. That guilt and secrets and all that stuff are like a poison that poisons our whole system, that allows us not to see life as life is. It's an incredible process that I experienced. And we often think in terms of the fifth step, of being the presenter of a fifth step, but I think every bit as important in many ways more important is the ability to hear a fifth step. And if you've never had the privilege of hearing someone's fifth step, I would really urge you to take advantage of it. There are a lot of places that they need people to hear fifth step. The first thing that comes to mind to me, of course, are prisons. I, for one, have never been much into volunteering to hear fifth steps at treatment centers. I love treatment centers. I really do. They're the greatest source of our new members. So to not like treatment centers is crazy. But I really have I'm pretty dubious about someone's ability to take a fourth and fifth step with 3 weeks of sobriety, counting detox meds. And so I do whatever I'm asked to do, but I don't volunteer particularly for that. I think if I have done it, and I have done it a few times I've been asked, I always point out to the person that this probably is not going to be your last fourth and fifth step, that you'll probably want to take another one after you do your second and third step. But I don't know. Just an opinion like everything else. But if you ever get a chance to hear fifth steps, I really urge you to please take advantage of that. It's an incredible phenomenon. You know, if you hear a lot of them, you'll have some experiences. I sponsored a man once that I couldn't stand this guy. I don't know if anybody's ever had this experience. I sponsor people that I don't particularly like in the beginning, and then I grow to love them very much. I started out not liking this guy, and 2 years later, I couldn't stand the sight of him. And it really bothered me, and I kept going to Tom saying, "Tom, can I fire him without cause?" And Tom says, "No," he said, "I think God sent him to you to teach you something." And I said, "What on earth is this creep teaching me?" I mean, I just couldn't stand him. I finally figured out what it was. The man was truly the most self-centered human being I ever met in my life. I remember I said to him one time, I mean, all he ever did was, and I mean, he's sober a while, just truly self-absorbed. I said to him one time, I won't call him by name, I'll call him Joe, that's not his name. I said, "Joe, enough about me. What do you think of my shirt?" And he never caught on. He just never caught on. I'd be with a new person, and this new person is beginning to talk a little bit and do this and do that. And Joe would have to shut him up so he could talk about himself. And he asked me to hear his fifth step, and I thought about lying and saying, "No, I'm afraid that my opinion of you is too important." But it would have been a lie. So I heard it, but I did something different than I usually do. I have a really nice room in our house that my wife and I have designated as sort of God's room. I mean, it's his house, but he has a room and a little chapel in there, and I like to pray in there and read scripture and do the things that I try to do every day. And I also hear fifth steps in there. We have two really comfortable chairs, except for when this guy came. And I took one of the comfortable chairs out, and I put a straight back chair in. And because I knew he loved the sound of his own voice, and we could be there for days. But, you know, I did learn in this man's fifth step. I really did learn something. And when this man would talk about the things that he had done, he was bragging. And I realized what the problem was. He had not one modicum of regret or guilt or anything. He was truly a sociopath. I'd never met one before. I'd acted like one on several occasions, but I never really met one who was sober a period of time and truly had no regret about anything he'd ever done. People were just pieces of furniture that needed to be moved around, and occasionally one got in his way. And I thought, "God, this is awful." So it scared me. So I went back to my sponsor. And I said, "Can I fire him now?" And Tom says, "You know, if you're right about him, he may kill you." I thought, well, I could put up with him a little while longer. Then he called me up. This is a true story. He called me up and he said, "I don't know how to tell you this." He said, this will probably ruin your whole day, but I have to move." And rather than lie, I didn't say anything. And I saw this man like 5 years later, and he said to me, he said, "I bet you haven't gotten over my having to leave yet." And I said, "You know, there's a lot in what you say." But that's the exception, and normally it's different than that. And what a privilege to be invited into someone's life, into that area or section of someone's life that no one else had ever been invited into before. I mean, what a privilege. I'm often, just thinking about it, I'm often moved to tears. And an amazing thing happens, and for people in this room who have heard a lot of fifth steps, you'll probably know this is true. An amazing thing happens. When it's over, I don't remember anything. I really don't. People will say to me, "Remember when I was telling you about such and such?" I go, "Geez, no, I don't. It's not that I don't think it's important. I know it's important. But something happens. I just don't remember that stuff." You know? And it's not important that anybody know it. It's just important that it be told to somebody, that it be told to another human being. You know, I was studying theology at
Georgetown, there was a theologian named Monica Helwig who wrote an explanation of the seven sacraments, and she's an interesting lady, and she talked about the sacrament of reconciliation, it's called now. It used to be called confession of penance. And she talked about part of the origin of that, the practice of it, not the origin, but part of the practice of it came from the men who went away in the Crusades. People at one time were raised in a village. They didn't think it took a village to raise them, but they hung around in one. There were great expectations involved in living in this village. And it was really, really important that you be accepted in your village, because if you weren't accepted, there was no place else to go. It's not like you could go to the next village, because at the next village, they'd say, why'd you leave the other village? You know? Well, if they don't want you, why should we? You know? And there was a horrible thing that could happen to you. It's called excommunication, which meant that nobody did anything to you. They just acted like you weren't there. And what a horrible sentence, you know, to not be there. And these guys go off their crusades, and they're gone a long time. You know, when you got drafted back then, it was for a long time. And they go off, and they found themselves doing things they never thought themselves capable of. Horrible things, terrible things. And they came back to their village, and people welcomed them back, and they treated them like heroes. And now they had secrets. They had done things that were completely unacceptable to them, and they loathed themselves. And of course, they went to the priest and they received absolution, but they didn't feel forgiven. And so the priest would say, well, why don't you ask the people in the village to pray for you? So they would do things like don sackcloth and ashes, and they put ashes on their heads, and they would sprinkle themselves with ashes, and they'd wear sackcloth, and they'd do all of that. And people would come into church, and they'd beg them to pray for them. And I think eventually what happened was people got tired of falling over these people outside the church all the time. And they said to them, they said, look, come on in. You did what you did. We'd have done the same thing in the same circumstance. Come back in. Be one of us. And I think to a large degree that's what happens to those of us who take the fifth step. And those of us who hear fifth steps have the privilege of saying, welcome back. You know, welcome back among the living. You know, you did what we did, or we would have done the same thing, or maybe did do the same thing in the same circumstance. You know, what you did, though you regret it and you feel guilty about it, one, it's not the end of the world, and two, it just says that you're a human being. And as long as we're alive, we can undo largely anything that we've done. And like we were talking about last night with my friend Happy Harold, you know, the thing you're most guilty about becomes the greatest gift. And that's some of the stuff that we're reminded of in the fifth step. And it's some of the stuff that we can remind the people that we hear fifth steps of. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the things the book says about choosing someone to hear your fifth step. A lot of people choose their sponsors, and I think that's fine. I'm really glad that Sandy asked me not to take it with him, because I think what he said was true, that he was a man of a great authority to me, and I had a tendency to try to present the very best side of myself to people of authority, and I'm awfully glad that he suggested that I go talk to somebody else, and I did that. I also went to a priest and talked to the priest about it. I thought that to be very, very important, and when we get into the eighth and ninth step, I'll be able to explain a little bit more of that. I often urge people who I hear their fifth step, I often urge them, if they need to seek professional help. We had a guy who I know not long ago who died because some unlicensed medical practitioners in Alcoholics Anonymous pulled him aside and told him to stop taking those pills that this doctor had given him. And the guy had a very serious disorder, and he stopped taking the pills because these medical experts told him to, and he ended up committing suicide. So I'm very, very cognizant of what the book says, and that is that there are truly experts in the world who are were there to help us with certain things. And and when I hear a fifth step, if I hear something that's so difficult for the person to deal with, I really urge them to go and find a professional and to seek professional help. Professionals are our friends. They're there to help us. If I was working with someone and I looked down and there was a bone protruding from their leg and they had a compound fracture, I would not tell them to work the sixth step. I'd tell them to go to a hospital and get someone who knows something about bones to set their leg. And I know that this may not have to be said, but I like to say it anyway, that there really are people who are experts. There are people who have been so damaged that those of us who have been less damaged probably shouldn't tell them not to worry about it, that they'll be okay. There have been people who have been so damaged by circumstances that they really need to get help for those circumstances. And the book tells us to seek help. I have heard the fifth steps of people who have been involved in multi-generational Satanism. And that's some horrible stuff that happens to people involved in multi-generational Satanism. A lot of sexual abuse at very early ages, and on and on and on and on. And they needed a human being to listen to them and to understand and to not be shocked. But I think some of these people also need a lot of spiritual and psychological and emotional guidance to overcome some of these things. And I'd always point out to them that everything's possible with God. And not only will you overcome this, but you'll become such a force in the lives of other people who have experienced the same thing that you're going to be one of the great gifts that God delivers to Alcoholics Anonymous. So there are a lot of ramifications to the fifth step, this business of admitting to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. A lot of ramifications. And it's a phenomenal responsibility and a great privilege. It's not the kind of responsibility that should have us be fearful. You know, when in doubt, talk to your sponsor. I've often checked, not telling them who he was or who the person was, but I've often gone to my sponsor with situations. I said, I don't really know how to respond to this, or I don't know what to do about this. What would you suggest? And my sponsors have also have been men who have been humble enough to say, you know, this might be something that requires professional help. And why don't you suggest that this person seek a professional? I keep a list of people who are professionals that I really believe know something about what it is we're trying to do. And I send people to those people, recommend that they see those people. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. A lot of people want to sit down. I ran into a woman at a conference not long ago, and she said, my sponsor told me to write my fourth step, and I wrote it down. Now she doesn't want to hear it. And I said, why? And she said, I don't know. She said that it's crazy. I said, what do you mean it's crazy? She said, well, I filled 6 notebooks. And she doesn't want to hear it. And I said, well, how old is she? You know, thinking that she may not have enough time left to hear it. And I pointed out to this young lady that if it's much beyond a few pages, it's probably bragging. And the step does say the exact nature of our wrongs. Now, it also says that we illuminate every nook and cranny. I know that. But not every blow-by-blow description. Every escape-oriented sexual escapade, there comes a point when it starts to be bragging. And it's the exact nature of our wrongs. And it's really interesting. And in this sixth step, we're going to see that this whole phenomenon of the nature of our wrongs is indeed a very important one. That as we look toward what makes us tick, as we look at these 7 deadly sins and how they portray themselves in our lives, it becomes increasingly important to recognize that there is an exact nature to our wrongs. Many of us have tendencies that the fifth step points out to us. How many people here who under pressure have a tendency to begin to lie just a little bit? You know? Yeah. You all know people who do that, huh? How many people here have a tendency when they're insecure to think about inappropriate sexual liaisons when you're feeling lonely. Huh? Yeah. Those are the exact nature of our wrongs. It's not a fun time to call your sponsor, but it's probably a good time to call your sponsor. I got myself into a lot of trouble along those lines, and I was very glad, and really glad, that early in my sobriety I really was sexually impotent, which kept me from a lot of trouble. I'll tell you, a lot of trouble. It caused me a lot of concern, but kept me out of a lot of trouble. The solution for all of these things isn't to not do it anymore. We're going to see in the sixth step that we just can't not do these things anymore. The solution is to be aware that this is how we deal with life. To be aware that most of the tools we develop throughout the course of our lives are warped. It's a wrench, but it's not the right wrench for the job. And it's a way of staying execution. It's a way of getting the heat off. It's a way of not looking at a certain area of our life. And I think to lead the spiritual life, Aristotle said a self-examined life isn't worth leading. A life that's not examined isn't worth leading. And I think that's true, and I think that we really need to look at our lives. And the fifth step begins a process where we begin to look at the motives for our actions, not just our actions. You know, early on, all that matters is our behavior. You don't drink. You don't drink. That's all that matters. You go to a meeting, you don't drink. That's all that matters. Somewhere along the line, they begin to change the rules on us. They begin to say, you know, what's important is your motives. Your motives may even be more important than what you do. Check your motives. I remember one time, I was sober about 3 or 4 months, and I wanted to say I began to get a handle on the impotence problem, but that wouldn't be stating it well. I guess I began to make some progress, and I was in a meeting one night, and Dan noticed that I was doing some 12-step work. I had given this very attractive woman a ride to the meeting, and Dan said, "I see you brought Peggy to the meeting." And I said, "Yes, she needed a ride." He said, "That's really nice of you." And he said, "It's especially nice because she lives about 30 miles out of town, doesn't she?" And I said, "Well, you know, nothing's too good for Alcoholics Anonymous." And and he said, "Well, I'm really proud of you." He said, this really warms the cockles of my heart to see you being such a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "You know, the amazing thing is that Susie lives next door to her, and she would probably be glad to take her home." And he said, "And then that would free us to go have a cup of coffee and talk about how well you're doing with the impotence problem." And and we went off and talked about motive for about 2 hours. Interesting topic, motive. But the fifth step is the first area where we begin to look at motive. It's interesting. You know, prior to that, we're not called on to look at motive. But, you know, motive is what spurs us. And if my motives are pure, if my motives are good, or even if they're less degenerate than they were, I know my life is improving. And I think the key to motives is to laugh at the bad ones, to look at myself and to laugh. I often imagine how it must be for God, who watches us progress from great sickness to relative health, and how much he must laugh at us, saying, "There he goes again. There he goes again." A lot of times when I'm working with the guys I sponsor, somewhere around the fifth step or shortly after the fifth step, I'll say to them, "You know, now it's time to do a budget." Budget? What's a budget got to do with being sober? I said, "A budget's got to do with living a comfortable life." So we do a budget. We sit down, and it always takes them a long time to do a budget. I don't know what it is. It takes them a long time to do a budget. A budget's a very simple thing. Here's how much I make, and this is how I spend it. But it takes them a long time to do a budget, and I'll ask them, "What's the motive for not doing a budget?" And the motive's always the same: I reserve the right to be irresponsible financially if I think it'll make me happy. And of course, that's crazy, because being irresponsible financially makes us miserable. It means that we never learn the value of what we have. We never know anything about saving. We never do any of those things. You know, this man who's retiring with $500,000 a year, I sat down with him and we did a budget. He'd never done a budget. Hell, you have that kind of money, you don't need a budget. You know? But of course he needed a budget, because the lack of budget is what caused the insecurity. He came to this startling conclusion that he could live on a mere $140,000 a year. He'd have a lot of money left over. He said, I really feel a lot freer. So I asked him the obvious question, what do you plan to do with some of the surplus? No, I didn't. No, I didn't. But I really believe that a big part of this inventory process or the ongoing process is a budgetary process. And, it, you know, if you're having financial problems, do a budget. And it's always the same. It's always fear-driven. Well, I'm afraid that I'll find out I don't have enough money. Well, of course you don't have enough money. If you had enough money, you wouldn't be in debt. Of course you don't have enough money. Let's find out why. We sit down and we do a budget. I'm working with a guy who... and I was telling him that Dan had me do a budget. Because I made the statement to Dan, I'm hopelessly in debt. And Dan said, that's ridiculous. He said, only the United States government is hopelessly in debt. He said, now I want you to make a budget. So I made a budget. And I, much to my surprise, we used to answer phones together on Monday night at the desk, the intergroup desk, from 7 till 10. So I used to take all my homework to Dan up there. So I took him my budget. And we looked it all over. Now, before I smoked cigarettes, which I did then, and before I ate, and before I put gas in the car, I was owning $100 a month in the hole. Now, that was a lot better than I thought it was. The problem with not knowing is it always feels worse than it is. And the fear is that if I find out how bad this really is, I'll die. And so I said, that's not so bad, $100. He said, that's right. And then he showed me how to prioritize my spending. And he told me, I want you to prioritize your spending. So I had rent. I thought that living on the street would be a bad way to be sober, so I put rent. And he said, no, it's wrong. He said, first is child support. He said, rent, just a financial transaction. He said, child support's a spiritual responsibility. I said, oh, you mean giving her money? A spiritual responsibility. He said, no. He said, supporting your children is a spiritual responsibility. She's just the one who signs the checks. I said, well, I feel better about that. And so that child support was first. And second was 50 cents a meeting. Budgeted 50 cents a meeting. And third, I owed this treatment center I'd gone to some money. And he said, you owe these people a lot. They introduced you to Alcoholics Anonymous. They took you when you were suicidal. You know, you'd have probably died without these people. What's this $5 a week? I said, well, that's all they want. He said, give them 10. 10. He said, give them 10. So 10. You know? And then we got down to rent. And then he helped me prioritize. And you know, it was amazing to me that when my next paycheck came and I sat down and wrote that child support check, I felt great about myself. I felt very differently than I had felt before, because this wasn't something I had to do or the judge would get me. This was a moral responsibility that I was fulfilling. And it began to change my whole attitude about life and about what I was doing. And when I got my 50-cent pieces and stacked them up for my AA meetings, within a year, he made me go to a dollar. But I had my 50-cent pieces and on and on. And then somehow there was always enough money to get by. I'd get this little job or that little job. But somehow once I did the budget, there was always enough money to get by. What I realized was that I didn't blow money the way I had when I was spending it and living in a disorganized fashion. I would respond to financial difficulties by buying things I didn't need. I want to say one other thing about finances, okay? And I think finances are important. When I sponsor guys, we spend a lot of time talking about finances. It's a very important. It's one of the leading causes of marriages breaking up, and it's one of the leading causes of people drinking and making stupid things. I grew up in poverty, okay? Now, some people say that that's a great spiritual challenge. You know, it may be. I had a saintly old grandmother who put it well. She's an Irish little, about 4 feet, 10 inches tall, and she was a drunk too, periodic. But she used to say to me, you know, Sonny, it's not a sin to be poor, but it's hellish uncomfortable. And so I knew a lot about poverty. And one of the things that happened, and my parents never did any of these things intentionally, but I think the way parents explain poverty to their kids is to somehow let them believe that people who have things are bad, that somehow they got them in a bad way. Remember, the man who owned a factory that my father worked in loved my father. My father was a wonderful worker. He was a machinist and a hard worker, and he was so insecure he'd never miss work, those things. And so he would try to invite, he would invite us out to Christmas at his house, and he lived in this mansion out in the country on a hill. It was a mansion. And my father would dress us all up. My father would say, "Now we're going to go to this man's house. For God's sake, don't touch anything." He says, he has lamps that cost more than our house. So we'd go to this guy's house and we'd sit there like this. And I remember looking, "Stay away from that lamp. If you break that lamp, they'll take our house away." And it was all so real to me, you know. And they're just trying to be nice to us. And we're not permitting it. We're not permitting it because of the fears that we had. And my sponsor called me up one time and he said to me, I want you to meet me over at the Foxhall meeting. The Foxhall meeting was in St. Patrick's Church, the corner of Foxhall in Georgetown, and very wealthy part of Washington, D.C. He said, "I want you to meet me at that meeting." I said, "I don't go to that meeting." And he said, "Why?" I said, "I don't like the people who go there. They're all rich snobs." He said, "Have you ever been there?" I said, "No." But I heard all about it. He said, "What have you heard?" I said, "Well, I heard that they have little finger sandwiches and stuffed mushroom caps and things like that, that all the blue-haired old ladies show up and make all this stuff, and that they drink coffee out of cups and saucers instead of styrofoam cups and stuff." I said, "I don't even think they're really a group of alcoholics nuns." And he said, "Well, yeah, they are." And he said, "This is a nice social event for a lot of those people." And he said, "They like to make it nice, and I want you to be there." I said, "Well, I'm not going." He said, "If you don't go, I'm going to break your knee." He was a big guy, so I went. But, you know, I found the rattiest clothes I could find. And I took my own styrofoam cup, thank you. And I'm going through the line, just a wreck, just angry and everything. And there was a man named Roland Harmon. Roland was a professor of romantic poetry at Georgetown University. And he had a handlebar mustache. And he had handlebar eyebrows. I've never seen anything like it. They curled in. And he was behind a little counter, and he leaned over and he said, "You're new, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "How do you like our meeting?" And I said, "The Swedish meatballs suck. Thank you very much." And he slapped me in the back of the head. He said, "Get through the line." And I went through the line and Hal M. and Sandy B. spoke, and I hadn't known him. I didn't hear a thing they were saying. I was sitting here. I had this turmoil and this craziness going on inside of my head. And when the meeting was over, he said to me, "We're going to talk." And we went outside and had a little garden outside. They've since torn the church down. It was a beautiful Episcopal church and had a little garden outside. And we sat on a stone bench, and he looked at me, and he said, "Keith, do you want to be poor the rest of your life?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You've arranged your life, so you must be poor the rest of your life." He said, "You're a hard-working guy." He said, "You've been reasonably successful for a guy who's been as drunk as you have." And he said, "What do you have?" And I said, "I don't have anything." And he said, "Isn't it true that when you begin to accumulate something, you go buy something stupid or you make a dumb investment and you lose it?" And I said, "Yeah, it's funny." I said, "What a bad luck." He said, "It's not bad luck." He said, "You put yourself in a position where you have to choose between having a few material things or being good." And he said, "It's time you discover that people who are blessed with material things can use those material things to help other people." And he said, "Stop being so prideful and so superior to these people." And he said, "Why don't you see what they have? And why don't you see how you can have what they have?" And, you know, it made perfect sense to me. I really had kept myself poor, and I'd never inventoried that part of my life. Because I grew up with a belief that if you had anything at all, if you were successful, then you did it by stepping on the neck of somebody else. And that's utterly nonsense, of course. So this inventory business is a very, very important one. And part of the inventory process, as we work with people and we help them, I believe, is the financial end of this thing. It's really very, very important to be financially responsible and to look at motives, not only in finances, but every other area of our lives. The fifth step is really a it tells us that it's the archway through which we walk through a new life. And it asks if it's been firm. Has our work so far been good? Has it been solid? Has the foundation been a good foundation? You know, have I truly come to believe and to know that I'm powerless over alcohol. So my life's become unmanageable. Have I truly come to believe that there's a plan for me? It has my name on it. It's called Keith's Plan. And God has devised a plan just for me. He loves me so much. Now, he can get anybody to do what it is he wants me to do, but he would rather I did it. And that's the second step. Or do I want to remain prideful and think that I have nothing that I can share with anybody else? And then do I want to make that decision, that commitment to turn my will and life over to the care of God as I understand him? And, you know, people always say, well, I don't understand God. I turn my will and life over to him as I don't understand him. And then my thought and my suggestion to them is that they find a way that they can begin to understand God. I think that the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is I finally found a system in which I could begin that process where I get to know God better and better. Yeah, I have brothers and sisters who have done that in the church we grew up in, and I do that in the church now too. But AA is the system that began the process for me. I understand more about the nature of God now than I did this time last year. Now, it's only scratching the surface, and it really doesn't amount to much. But the truth of the matter is that I know more about the nature of God than I did before, and that's God as I understand him. And it's my responsibility to continue to grow spiritually, to get to know him better. And we'll talk about that in the 11th step. And in the fourth step, we made a list of these character defects, the things that the repetitive behaviors, the natural instincts that have gone awry, that have warped our lives, that have left us with little defense against the next drink, that left us wallowing in self-pity and self-loathing and all the things that go with it. And then we finally arrived at the time when we've sort of come out, and we come out by sharing with God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And what a privilege to be involved in a process where people make decisions upon which the rest of their lives turn. And I think that's what the first five steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are all about. They put us in a position where we can make decisions upon which the rest of our lives turn. And more importantly, it puts us in a position to work with others to help them to make the decision upon which the rest of their lives are going to turn. It's a miraculous and amazing phenomenon to watch. And why don't we take a break and we'll get back with step six. Thank you. And we were at step six. We're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Step six was one of those steps. I guess there were two steps when I originally looked at the 12 steps that I thought were kind of throwaway steps. And I thought there were throwaway steps in that I believe that a reasonable person would want to do that. My thought was in the second step, for example, was once I recognized that I was powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable. I mean, any reasonable human being would look for a power greater than themselves to restore them to sanity. Once I knew I couldn't, it was reasonable to assume that I would find someone who could. The problem with that theory is that I wasn't a reasonable man. I was a sick alcoholic. And I think the same is true with the sixth step. There's a great belief, and I see it reflected in meetings around Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a great belief that somehow insight is the prize. That somehow, if I know what's wrong with me, I won't do it anymore. If I understand that my problem is as if mother had a square nipple, it won't affect me anymore. And you know, if I know that I lie under pressure, then I won't lie anymore. When I get under pressure, I'll say, you're under pressure, don't lie. And that makes a lot of sense until there's pressure. And then my head is saying one thing, and my mouth is lying. And my head's saying, don't lie. And my mouth says, you stay out of this. I'm responsible for how we look. And if I don't say something, we'll look bad. The sixth step is an amazing step. The book says it's a step that separates the men from the boys. I don't want to be a bit controversial, and I mean that, but Sandy explained to me, I said to him one time, everybody talked about the big book, and Sandy always had me study and read to me from the 12 and 12, and I said, no, he told me to read the big book, but whenever we did the steps, he did them in the 12 and 12, and I said to him one time, you know, why is that? And he said, well, I really like the big book. He said, but when Bill wrote the big book, he's sober about 3 years. And he said, when he wrote the 12 and 12, he's sober about 15 years. He said, if he didn't learn anything in 12 years, we're all in a hell of a lot of trouble. And I've come to realize that what he meant was that Bill had sort of expanded on his concept as they relate to the steps in the 12 and 12. And that's one of the things that makes it such an interesting workbook. And if you look in the big book, the 6 steps is one paragraph. You know, we go away, for an hour, we look at these first 5 propositions, where we thorough, now we're at step 6, you know, now we're ready to take step 7. So we say to our creators, we understand them, Then, 12 years later, he writes a book and he says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys, so says, you know, one of the clergymen who's a friend of our fellowship. And I think what happened was people began to realize the tremendous difficulty involved in changing. That self-knowledge avails us nothing. That insight can be the booby prize. It's a lot like being hit by a truck. You know, if you've been hit by a truck and you're laying in the middle of the street and somebody runs out to you and you say to them, don't worry, I have the license number of the truck. Well, that's interesting. And if you ever go to court, it might even be important. But you probably want an ambulance. And to think somehow that insight stimulates change is crazy. If you don't believe it, go to a meeting of old timers and talk about your feelings. They'll be pretty quick to tell you they're not interested, as they did me. They'll be quick to say things like, we don't care how you feel. We want to know what you're doing. Or go to many meetings now where somebody will say, does anybody here have a problem? I want to jump up and say, I'm an alcoholic. That's why I'm here. Of course I have a problem, you know. But somebody will say, yes, I discovered that mother had a square nipple. And 40 untrained psychiatrists will offer their opinion on what this means. And then one of my favorites, my sponsor told me to come to this meeting and share this. So they share something, you know. And then it gets to be my turn, and I'd say, why don't you fire your sponsor? He's not doing his job. He's inflicting you on us. I was in a meeting not long ago, and I often don't do this. I have pretty strong opinions in my home group, but when I'm outside of that, I really usually behave fairly well and keep my mouth shut, unless I'm leaving town soon. But I was at a meeting, and this woman, nice lady, good member, she said, does anybody here have a problem? And this guy who's been around and around and around and around and around comes up with a problem. And the group reacts in one of two ways. Half of them sympathize with him. The other half beat the hell out of him for bringing up a dumb problem. So at the very end, she called on me. Now, I was content to pass and keep my mouth shut and not say anything. But at the very end, she called on me. And I figured that was a call from God to say something. Seize on any opportunity, you know. And so I said, it's amazing to me that someone asks a question in a room full of alcoholics. Does anybody here have a problem? I said, the sickest, most self-centered member, of course, has one. And then we spend an hour beating the hell out of them for it. You know, it makes no sense to me at all. You know, and of course, then everybody was offended. But it's as though somehow talking about these problems in a group of people changes them. And of course, that isn't what changes them. Now, you know, what it does is it it gets us and everybody else sick and tired of the problem, and eventually you give it up because nobody pays attention anymore. Maybe that helps. I remember when I came in, I had this terrible sleep problem. I don't know if anybody had the sleep problem. My sponsor, Dan, assured me that all of them had it, but it would be all right, but that wasn't good enough. And at the end of the meeting, they'd always say things like, does anybody here have a problem that might cause them to drink? And I put up my hand. They go, what is it now, Keith? I'd say, I can't sleep. And then they'd take turns saying, nobody ever died from not sleeping. Now, you really don't want to talk that way to somebody who hadn't slept in a while. And I just jumped up one night and screamed, no, but people die from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping. And I don't know if talking about not sleeping ever did anything for my sleep or not. I really don't know that. And I'm not suggesting that it's not important to talk about things that are problems, but I think that's what sponsorship's for. I think that if somebody would ask me to make a criticism of the program as I see it, I would only make one, and that is that we don't have strong sponsorship much anymore. A lot of our members think that sponsorship is parenting, and so a lot of the people who seek sponsors seek parents, and if they don't parent them the way they want to be parented, they go find other parents. I was told that the sponsor was a person who would guide me and direct me into using the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are the steps of the program. It would teach me how to be a member of the fellowship, and it would also teach me how to work the steps. And if I can become a good member of the fellowship, you know, if I can do things like watch my language and shake hands and look people in the eye and be available to the new person and give them my phone number, if I can do that, and I can work the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can recover. I can experience a psychic change that results in living a fairly normal life. And I think that's fairly simple. Now, a lot of our problems appear to be pretty complicated, but I think the solution is simple. And one of the things I see that caused me some consternation is the fact that often meetings have degenerated or deteriorated into group therapy sessions. Group therapy is a wonderful thing. I've gone to it and have benefited from it greatly, but that isn't what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I do in Alcoholics Anonymous is I go to where a group of people are who teach me how to work the program. They talk to me about the principles involved in living a life in Alcoholics Anonymous. They talk about resentments, and they talk about solutions for resentments. Alcoholics Anonymous is a solution-oriented way to live. And it involves a lot of action. Our friend Father Bob H. from over in on the East Coast in Lauderdale says it very well. He talks about the man who strung a wire across Niagara Falls. And he got a wheelbarrow, and he got on the wire, and he pushed his wheelbarrow clear across the falls. And by the time he got to the Canadian side, people were cheering and carrying on, and there was a whole crowd of people there. So he got down, and they had a microphone set up, and he said, do you believe I can push a wheelbarrow across Niagara Falls? And they said, yeah, we believe it. Said, do you really believe it? He said, we absolutely believe it. We saw it with our own eyes. We believe it can happen. And he said, you, sir, do you believe it? He said, yes, I do. He said, get in the wheelbarrow. You know? And Alcoholics Anonymous is asking us to get in the wheelbarrow. And I think that's what the sixth step says. The sixth step says, get in a wheelbarrow. It's not a benign step. It's a step filled with action. What I do with the guys that I sponsor is I have them carry this little notebook around with them and have them maybe take one character defect at a time and to see how it enters into their life on a daily basis, how these character defects, these living problems, have become such a part of our lives that merely sharing them won't change the stage of doing anything else. The big lie is, now that I know what's wrong with me, I won't do it anymore. And that's what the sixth step says. The sixth step says that knowing what's wrong with you won't make you change it. Knowing what I'm doing that's wrong won't cause me to change doing what's wrong. In the sixth step is the process where I try to change on my own. I'm convinced that's exactly what it is. The sixth step is the process where I make up my mind I'm not going to steal anymore. You know? And you know, I leave a job and by damn I have another stapler. You know? They owe me a stapler. I mean, they've never paid me what I'm worth. You know, the average person couldn't use up one stapler in an entire lifetime, you know? And I have a half a dozen staplers at home. Some will never be used. And they'll be inherited by people who are in the program who also have a half dozen staplers. And the day will come when somebody will have a warehouse full of used staplers, which were stolen with the justification that they've never paid me what I'm worth. I got a good look at this in me when I was in the subtle ways that in which we can steal. I was an officer in a hospital corporation some years ago, and I was leaving, and I had had some difficulty with the management of this particular corporation. It wasn't a new experience for me. It was another experience for me. I handled it better, meaning that this time I just didn't walk out. I made them pay me to leave, but I wasn't any more successful at having accomplished. I just got out better. And I was hurt and I was angry and I was all the things that I always was when I set these situations up and brought them about. And one of the things that they gave me was a new Buick Riviera. And I had been driving it about 6 months, and not much, because I was on airplanes a lot. So the car sort of sat in the airport, and then it sat at the office, and then it sat at my apartment. And part of what they were supposed to do was they paid for all expenses related to that car. And so about a week before I left, I did what any normal person would do who'd been wronged. I took the car over to a dealership and said to the guy, "What's the most expensive set of tires you have here?" And the guy was in my home group, and he said, "What are you going to put new tires?" He said, "Those tires are brand new." He said, "God, they still have those little knobs on them." I said, "I didn't ask you to assess the tires I have. I asked you to sell me the most expensive set of tires you can get your hands on. If you have to order them, I'll wait." And he looked at me, and so he tells this story. He loves to tell this story. So he got me these tires, and they were expensive tires, I'll tell you. And I said, "Make out the bill to the company." He said, "All right." And he said, "I'll never forget." He said, "Keith," he said, "you got in the car," and he said, "you pulled out," and he said, "you started out of the driveway, and you started down the street," and he said, "then your brake lights came on." And he said, "you sat in the middle of the street for about 30 seconds. He said, "then you put on your backup lights, and you backed into the garage and said, put my old tires back on. I'll pay whatever I have to pay, but don't bill the company." Well, you know, I was going to do what I'd always done. I was going to steal from the company by making them buy me a set of tires I didn't need. And that was my way of showing them who I was. My ex-wife summed me up pretty well one time. She said to me, she said, "you know, I wish you'd die, but we can't afford it." And I said, "what do you mean?" I said, "I'm worth a lot more dead than I am alive." She said, "yeah, but we couldn't afford to bury you." I said, "what are you talking about?" She said, "well, the special made coffin." "What are you talking about?" She said, "well, you know, that coffin with the special made lid so you could lay for all eternity with your arm and finger extended to the world." And she described beautifully and perfectly how I dealt with the world. The second step talks about defiance. And my character defects support the defiance that I always had about the world. And I would have one more time done something that I would have had to make amends to this company for. I would have stolen from them one more time. And I knew my pattern, and I did it anyway. You know, it's one thing to experience the guilt and the forgiveness that happens in the fourth and fifth step, for having lived the life I lived. But what's excruciatingly painful for an alcoholic of my type is to continue to do the things I talked about in the fifth step, even when I don't want to do them. And that's the sixth step. You know, they have some copies in here of the original manuscript of the big book, and if you don't have a copy of that, I would really urge you to get a copy. It's illuminating. I don't know if you've ever read it, but Bill wrote this manuscript. Bill and the other members wrote this manuscript, and they passed it around to a lot of people. And one of the people they gave it to was a psychiatrist, and a non-alcoholic psychiatrist. And they asked him to read this, and he read it. And he said, "That's very interesting." He said, "But that's not what you guys do." Bill said, "What do you mean?" No. He said, "That's not what you do." He said, "You don't talk to people like that." And what happened in the original manuscript is it didn't say "we." It said, "You will. You will. You will." So like they used to call the Al-Anon salute, you know. You know, the handshake, the Al-Anon handshake. "You will." You know. And the doctor said, "That isn't the way you talk to alcoholics. The way you talk to alcoholics is you tell them what you did, not what they have to do." You know. And in that, in the original manuscript, in the 12 steps, it talks about step 7. And in step 7, we say, humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. In the original manuscript, it said, humbly on our knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, holding back nothing. And the self-loathing that I experienced when I did the fifth step was nothing compared to the self-loathing I did when I finally took the sixth and seventh step. Because I spent a few years after my fifth step trying to live the kind of life I knew I wanted to live and the kind of life I knew I would have lived if only I had known what was right. And I found that I failed miserably at living the kind of life that I wanted to live. I failed miserably. I fell into every trap. I got involved in every form of behavior that I had gotten involved in before. Only this time I knew exactly what I was doing. And I want to tell you, it was the most painful time of my life. I'm convinced that there are periods of sobriety that are difficult. There are time frames that I may be wrong about this, but I've just been through them myself, and I've watched people, and I've worked with people. And I'm convinced, for example, that 13 months is a very difficult time. You know, we live with this magical thinking that somehow a year is magical. It's a lot like being 16. Remember when being 16? Well, if I could only be 16. And then pretty soon I'm 16 in a week. And I'm the same pimply-faced little puke I was a week before. You know? Nothing had changed. And then being 18. Well, if I'm 18, you know, when I'm 18, and I'm, you know, as 18, a busted kidney, I'm in a hospital outside of Parris Island, South Carolina. It's the same puny little nut I'd been before. And then when you're 21, that's going to be magical, remember? When you're 21, it's going to be magical. And so I always lived with this sort of magical thinking that somehow, somewhere along the line, I'll get to a point where everything's going to be okay. And I carried that magical thinking into the sixth and seventh steps. Somehow I'll be the person I want to be, because now I know what's wrong with me. I won't do it anymore. And 18 months is often a difficult time. 18 months is often when we begin seeking balance. And we go hunting for balance. I have only two things I keep in my original big book. Two things, both related to life according to Keith. One of them is a fortune from a fortune cookie from the China Doll restaurant in Washington, D.C., and I have it dated and everything. I got tired of waiting for God to arrange a decent relationship for me, so I went looking on my own, and I invited a young lady who worked in the neonatal nursery at the hospital, and I took her to Chinatown, to the China Doll restaurant. And she was not a woman who was very accomplished in the art of drinking. So sober now, about a year and a half out trying to seek balance, I began to feed her warm sake in large amounts. And I about had her where I wanted her, and the fortune cookies arrived. And I opened my fortune cookie, and the fortune said, "What sobriety conceals, drunkenness reveals." And I read it and said, "Holy shit." And I, she said, "Excuse me." And I said, "I'll be right back." And I ran to the phone and I called Dan. Dan was a man of few words. He said, "You're where? You're doing what?" I said, "You get that girl home and you get your ass over here." "Okay, Dan, okay." You know, so I took her home. She's pulling up my clothes and everything. I mean, I was right. I could have had some balance that night. I'm helping her to her apartment. I won't stay. She's calling me a homosexual and a lot of other things. So I went over to see Dan, and Dan said to me, Keith, you can't use people like this. People aren't designed to be used by you. Who do you think you are? Boy, he really chewed me. He didn't get upset with me often, but he sure did then. I said, aren't you going to tell me that a lot of us seek balance? We've all had that problem. He said, I'm not telling you that this time. You write that woman a letter and you apologize to her. Boy, I had to do all that stuff. That's the one thing that's in my big book. The other thing that's in my big book was I was sober about 5 or 6 years. And I decided somewhere along the line that there were certain things I wanted to accomplish. I put together my wish list. A wish list is the way it ought to be if I were running the world. And then I can make it happen, you see. I can make it materialize by focusing and concentrating on it. And one of the things on my wish list was to work in a foreign country. And I'd studied in France and I'd done some things, but I wanted to work in a foreign country because that's what cool people do. I don't know where I came up with that one. But once it was on my wish list, it was supposed to happen. And so I applied for the only job I've asked for sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a job that would have put me in a country where I wouldn't have had the kind of support I needed, et cetera, et cetera. And 6 years is a very difficult time in Alcoholics Anonymous. 6 years of sobriety is often a difficult time for a lot of people, as is 3 years and 6 years and 12 years and 20 years. I mean, they're just... just the way it is. My sponsor tells me 40 years is no deal, but no, I'm just kidding. My solution to life wasn't to do what I needed to do next. My solution to life was to find a solution. And my solution was to be an international businessman. And I'd have been in a country where I wouldn't have had the kind of support I needed and everything else. And I must tell you what happened to me in the following year. If I'd have been where I wanted to be, I think I'd have died drunk. And the only job I ever asked for in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a telegram telling me I wasn't chosen for it. And I keep that in my big book, just to indicate to me that the two times I took charge of my life, the results were or would have been disastrous. And that's what the sixth step is all about. The sixth step is to teach me those principles, that I don't know what's best for me. And knowing what my character defects are, doesn't qualify me to know what's best for me. I can't remove my character defects. I want to talk about one other thing that I see associated with this sixth and seventh step, this whole business of affirmations. Now, I think affirmations are wonderful things. I really do. See, I just affirm myself. But to take a person who has no framework, no spiritual foundation of any kind, and to begin this process of affirmation. My ex-wife was seeing, well, we were still married at the time, but she was seeing a psychologist, which explained part of why I drank. I was married to a crazy woman. She kept talking to my psychologist about the amount I was drinking. And he asked if I would come in to talk to him to help her. Well, I'm a nice guy. I'm willing to do anything to help my wife, so I went in to see him, and I knew what she was telling him. She's telling him a bunch of lies about my drinking. But I made up my mind I was going to be as honest as I could be. So he said to me, how much do you drink? And I told him, I counted differently. If I didn't pay for it, I didn't count it as drinking. So I counted what I paid for, and it was about half of what I drank. But it was still a lot, I said to him, I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he said, no, I don't. He said, I don't think you're an alcoholic. He said, if you keep drinking this much, you will be. I said, well, when, doctor? I didn't want to become an alcoholic. My plan was to quit about 6 months before it was too late. He didn't answer me, but he did say, he said, your problem is you have a poor self-image. And he turned to my wife, and he said, and you're part of the problem. And I was thinking, I don't know what this guy costs, but he's worth every dime of it. He told me, he said, Keith, you need to be affirmed. And so he made for me a list of affirmations. They were Keith's affirmations. They weren't anybody else's, they were mine. And the way this worked was, I was to get up every morning, and they were double-spaced, big letters. They had a Selectomatic typewriter. I thought it was a wonderful invention. They could make big letters. And they had big letters, Keith's affirmations. And I was to stand, or two pages of them. And I was to stand in front of the mirror every morning, and I was to affirm myself. And my wife, if she could, was to stand next to me while I did this, because if she were present while I was affirming myself, that would be further affirmation, and it would make up for some of the dastardly ways in which she had treated me to tear me down as a human being. And I was so pleased to find out I wasn't an alcoholic, I got very drunk that night. So I was affirming myself alone the next morning, you can imagine. And I was standing in front of this mirror, and I looked into those yellow bloodshot eyes, and I read from my list, "Keith, today you're a winner." "Today you're a good husband," kind of regardless of what she thought. "Today you're a good father. Today you're a good researcher. Today," so I get about halfway through that list, and I said, "Today you're full of crap. That's what you are." I may have been an alcoholic, but there was still a modicum of honesty left in my life. And I came to realize that I could never be convinced of something like this. And of course, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we do is we tear out the weak foundation and rebuild the foundation. And then upon that foundation is when affirmation happens. But affirmation doesn't happen because I stand in front of a mirror and say it's true about me. I mean, hell, I've never trusted me. I've been sober almost 25 years, and it amazes me that you trust me. I mean, my affirmation happens in the eyes of the new guy. The eyes of the new guy, when he says to me things. You know, people have said to me, a guy said to me not long ago, he said, "I'd give anything if I could live my life the way you live your life." I said, "Really? You've been watching? How am I doing?" He said, "You're doing fine. I'd love to be you." That's the kind of affirmation that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because someone asks us to be their sponsor because of who we are and how we live. That's the affirmation. I only know I'm okay in the eyes of a new man. That's how I know I'm okay. You know? And it's not because I tell myself I am. And it's not because I get that job or I make that much money or I do any of that stuff. The only thing that tells me who I am is the way I'm living my life on a daily basis. You know, the sixth step is a step that convinces me that left to my own devices, I can never do that. Left to my own devices, I can only do what I used to do. I may be a little smoother about it. You know, I may be a little more subtle in my manipulation. But I'll continue to feel the need to manipulate life to suit me because I don't have the ability to do it any differently. And then in the seventh step, it says, humbly on our knees, we ask God to remove these defects of character, holding back nothing. One day, in tears, I wept and I begged God, "Please help me to never treat women the way I've treated the last one. Please." And I can tell you when it happened to me. It was July the 4th, 1985. And I'd been in another one of those usurious relationships where we both lied to each other and we just were more subtle about the whole thing. It was the same sort of destruction, the same sort of sick, empty feeling left on the inside when we didn't get what we wanted, and that sort of thing. And it was just sick. And I was at a friend's house, a man named Bob Brown, and I was in his guest room, and my friend Dick Corcoran, and Dick's passed away. Dick has a friend here. Dick was one of my best friends. Dick taught me how to pray, and he taught me how to read scripture, and he taught me just about everything I know in the spiritual walk. He took me by the hand and brought me back to the church I was raised in. But Dick knew something was going on, and he came in after I was already in bed, and I prayed all night. I spent most of the night on my knees begging God to make me different. And I told God when the sun was coming up, I said, "I'm going to do it differently with your help. I'm going to live a celibate life alone. And I'm not going to ask for anything else. I'm going to ask only that I be of maximum service to you and to my fellows. And I'm going to put my interpersonal life in your hands." And I came out of the room, and Dick was smiling, and I said, "I was up all night." He said, "I know, I was praying too." He said, "I have a feeling it's going to be okay." And that night I went to a meeting I didn't want to go to because my friend Bob was speaking, and so I went, and I met the woman that I later married. And I know that had I not made that commitment to God, that I would have destroyed that relationship like I destroyed all the other relationships I'd ever been in because of my character defects. I know that's